John Hansen in for John Williams, everyone, on this Tuesday afternoon, 2:07. Thank you so much for joining us. Steve, thank you very much for the news. And Lauren with the traffic, excuse me. And Elif in the producer booth.
We're all being paid to be here.
I know. I can still say thank you. Thanks for showing up. Thanks for not phoning it in. You still gave me a full 7 minutes of news. Lauren with a complete traffic report. Just because we're on the stream, we don't cut corners here.
No.
Not at all. Steve's actually reporting from his house right now. He's just calling in. He's literally phoning it in. I'm just kidding. I'm looking up at the phone or on the camera. Okay, great transition over to our next topic. I'm a history buff. I love all things history, and I find it fascinating even to dive into horrific topics of war. I think that's sometimes where we get our most interesting and global changes, and certainly the war on terrorism and terrorism in general is certainly a hot topic, whether we're talking about domestic terrorism or international terrorism. And I wanted to have a chat with a professor from my alma mater, the University of Illinois. Professor John Lynn joins us right now. Professor Lynn, thanks so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
I got to ask you first and foremost, how's Greg Hall doing?
Gregory Hall is doing pretty well, except that Wright Street is so torn up you can hardly get around campus. Literally, they ripped the whole street out. It'll be ready by the time the students show up in a few weeks, but it's pretty much of a mess.
That's what they say. I was down there in March to speak to some students at the college radio station there, WPGU, where I worked for some time as a student, then as a young adult or babysitter, I guess I called myself. And I saw Wright Street was really ripped up during the time. For those of you that don't know or have never been down to the campus, that is kind of one of the main arteries just off the quad. But enough about the University of Illinois. I wanted to hear to chat about your book, Another Kind of War, The Nature and History of Terrorism. Before we get into the book, Professor Lynn, how did you get into this sort of history, the history of war?
Okay. I've been a military historian for a very long time, four decades. And when 9/11 struck, my feeling was, what did I know? What had I learned? What was I sensitive, for want of a better word, to? What connections could I see from my experience as a military historian to deal with terrorism? And, in fact, the whole nature of the book, Another Kind of War, is to argue that terrorism really is another kind of war, or at least the radical sub-state group kind of terrorism. And I actually call it an entry level for war. It's the first step of using violence in your political dialogue.
When you say it's just another kind of war, it's interesting because I think that, you know, and it's, you mentioned 9/11. I was, not to date myself either direction, but I was a high school senior on September 11th. I will never forget I was in AP history on September 10th on the Monday, and I was reading about Samuel Huntington, a famous professor, and I was reading about the clash of civilizations about future wars would be fought between tribal, sort of entities as opposed to, nation states. Mm-hmm. And it didn't quite sink in. And then, of course, the next day happened, and well, of course, that had been brewing for a long time before 9/11, of course, with the attack on the USS Cole and the Trade Center many years before that.
Right.
It sort of made a lot more sense to me as a senior in high school. I find it interesting that you considered it another kind of war, because I think that the language that we used oftentimes when we talk about terrorism are that all the rules are different. Everything has changed. It's not the sort of wars that we've had in the past. So is your argument that, or your discussion really based on the idea that this is just the newest phase of wars that were fought in different ways, but along sort of similar beliefs and motivations?
Well, first of all, yes, the notion of a clash of civilization, you realize radical Islamists use that language themselves, and knowing that it is Samuel Huntington's idea. And in fact, they believe, and I'm talking about radical Islamists, the kinds who carry bombs and shoot people, they believe there is a Western war against Islam, and that morally requires them to engage in a war to defend Islam, which we call jihad. Now, you have to recognize that they're all, you know, we already have different levels of warfare nowadays. Since World War II, we have the possibility, hopefully not the reality, of nuclear warfare. Mm-hmm. We have conventional warfare. We have insurgencies. Now, and in fact, there's a new be dealing with cyber war, criminality, terrorism, insurgency, and conventional war all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So we do believe that there are different levels of warfare. If you look back at Mao Zedong, the great guerrilla leader of China in the 30s and 40s, and eventually Chairman Mao, he posited that the way you achieved your political goals as revolutionaries was to begin as guerrillas, then you moved up to what he called mobile warfare, which was a combination of more regular style units plus guerrillas, and then eventually the conventional war.
Mm-hmm.
That was influential in the way I looked at terrorism because I thought, you know, what's happened is terrorism has become the level below insurgency. And it, too, is a first entry point into a violent struggle, which then can evolve to other levels.
Mm-hmm.
So I do see it as another kind of war. I realize that when we think of war, we're normally sort of trying to think of a situation in which armed people fight armed people, that it's not the defenseless civilian who's being, you know, a soft target for terrorists. But in reality, warfare has always involved attacks on civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And quite consciously, I'll perhaps enrage some of your listeners here, but the British bombing offensive in World War II was quite consciously conceived of as a terror campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Sir Arthur Harris, who was the head of Bomber Command, literally used that language.
You're referring to when the British bombed German cities, the civilians that lived in them, yes.
Yes, most obviously things like Hamburg and Dresden, but other bombing offensives as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were regarded by certain American generals, including, by the way, Jimmy Doolittle, who called them the typical British baby-killing raid.
Hmm.
Okay? Now, I'm not trying to just kind of shock people, but the point is that there's always been a part of war which is directed against those who cannot defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in terrorism, of course, that's the primary thing, is you're choosing soft targets because you're weak, you can't go head-to-head with major forces, and so you're attacking those who cannot defend themselves.
I was reading that the idea, you know, we've always been told that terrorism is meant to strike fear in those that that they attack, which I imagine to some extent is true, but I imagine you've written the idea that it's also to kind of, I don't want to say keep you on your, it's meant to throw you off your game.
A lot of things, but my major point is that while yes, fear is involved because you know these attacks on the innocent and the unprepared are meant to be morally shocking, and they're also meant to make you feel vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I talk about is fear and outrage. Fear tends to make you go inside yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Outrage makes you do things. That are active. You are going to say things and do things in revenge or in reprisal or what have you. Those are often very useful to the very people who are committing the terrorism.
Hmm.
They want you to overreact. They want you to say the inappropriate things because they're using you to make themselves stronger. That's hard for some people to grasp, but it is this notion of the act is not just being something to create fear, but to incite a provocation.
So when you talk about the nature and history of terrorism, how far back do you go chronologically?
Okay. People will tell you there have been acts that match a definition of terrorism, you know, back in the ancient world and kind of stuff. I don't really think that matters much. I believe that terrorism comes out of the middle of the 19th century at a time when other forms of political protest became obsolete. For example, crowd actions in the street, raising barricades for a European revolution. The last time that works is 1848, and by the end of those revolutions of 1848-49, the barricade's been discredited by the fact that it doesn't work. The crowds are overcome, the resistance is destroyed, and the old regime returns. So I argue, and you can see it in the literature of radicals at the time, they're saying, we can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We have to turn to attacking softer targets, being more, more immoral.
Right, so they start speaking in that language that we still see today.
Yeah, in fact, there is a guy, a German. He ends up, by the way, in the United States, in Louisville, and then eventually, I guess it's in Cambridge or New York, I'm not sure which. His name is Karl Heinzen. And in response to his experience in those revolutions, he writes, we now have to commit murder. And he writes a book called Murder and Liberty. And he says, the other people are murdering us. We have to murder. We have to go against the normal morality,
mm-hmm.
in the name of a greater cause. And terrorism really is about the ends justifying the means.
In your book, do you focus more on international acts of terrorism? Do you address at all domestic terrorism?
I do everything.
Okay.
My book is meant to be a kind of first book. I don't assume people know much about history. I don't assume they know much about terrorism or war. So I have, first of all, I distinguish between when states commit terrorism, when militaries do it, when social groups do it. In fact, I would argue the greatest terrorism problem in American history is white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been forever, and I have two chapters on that in the book. But what concerns us most obviously is terrorism, is by terrorism by small groups with some sort of a cause. And that's one of those causes is white supremacy. But there's lots of other causes, too, as we know. Because once you know that other people have used terrorism and it works or it seems to work, then it becomes part of the way you react, the way you try to go from being powerless to having more power and more influence.
When you talk about, white nationalism, would you, obviously we've had a couple recent attacks, and we're still waiting to get complete, angles of what the motives were, certainly out of Ohio, out of El Paso. El Paso, we've had the manifesto published, allegedly sent by the shooter. I mean, even though, I don't know if there was any coordination, I'm sure they're looking into it between other white nationalists or other groups. Even if there's not, as a solo actor of terrorism, does that shooter still fall within the realm of what you kind of talk about?
Here's another one of my sayings. A lone wolf implies there's a pack somewhere. In other words, to call somebody a lone wolf terrorism is not somebody simply acting out of something that's entirely self-generated, that in fact they have been influenced by, are at least self-associated with some greater cause. And when I say greater, I don't mean good, but some larger cause. And I think when you look at what happens at El Paso, that certainly passes the test to me for one of those lone wolves who's really responding to a pack. And by the way, so was Timothy McVeigh back in 1995.
Right, in Oklahoma City, certainly.
Right. They didn't come out of nowhere.
When you look at who might purchase your books, you kind of mentioned that you don't assume that the person might know a ton about history or the history of terrorism or terrorism in general. Do you think that's a good book to read to kind of give everyone context as they have these discussions? Because, unfortunately, we're going to continue with these discussions domestically and internationally.
I can't agree with you more. And I also feel that learning about terrorism is a kind of act of civil defense. If you know that they're trying to use you, trying to get you to do something that they want to do, you learn that the first question you ask after a terrorist event is not how do we get back at them, but what do they want us to do? For example, you can make a very strong case, and I do make a strong case, that bin Laden was hoping that we were going to get ourselves involved in a war in the Middle East. In fact, his number two guy, just a few months before 9/11, said, we want to get America into a war. And there are three places where it would work: in Somalia, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Wow. On the nose.
Yeah, on the nose. On the nose. The one thing that people don't understand is terrorists may be radicals, and they may do things that are morally inconceivable to you or me. But they're not crazy. They do learn from experience. They learn from history. learned from military theory, even the radical Islamists, I can prove that one, so that they are rational actors. I don't mean reasonable. Rational actors learn, make plans, learn from the failure or success of what they've done in the past, adjust, and go at it again.
Terrorists
are rational actors.
Do you think that we need to have a much better understanding of their motives and their modus operandi to have a better assessment of what they're doing, and also then to create, I don't know if measured responses is the right answer,
proportional response?
I don't know what the right answer is.
No. I talk a lot about a sense of proportion. Because essentially, terrorism is a kind of psychological warfare. They're doing something to get in your head. And then in getting into your head, of having a psychological impact on you, they hope then out of that will grow a political effect that they want. You've got to learn not to be manipulated. Now, you know, different forms of terrorism, you know, have kind of different drives. I think the radical right in the United States operates in somewhat different ways than, say, the radical Islamists in the Middle East, or even those lone wolves that show up on our own shores. But there is that element of it's a kind of psychological warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And if you learn to understand, you can help keep yourself from being manipulated by these acts. That's why I say the first question is, what do they want us to do?
It's another kind of war, the nature of history of terrorism. Professor John Lynn from the University of Illinois down in Urbana-Champaign. Professor, thanks for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure, sir.
And good luck with Wright Street and the students. They're coming back sooner than you realize.
I love to teach, and I love to have the students around. And by the way, I went to the University of Illinois, too.
Ah, that's right. You did for your undergrad and ILL.
Yes, as I said, I came out of undergraduate school with two things, a BA and a wife.
Well, those are two.
And she's down the hall right now.
Oh, really?
After 54 years.
Oh, well, congratulations there, and congrats on the book, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. More to this on WGN.